Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is Monday, 9/9/13. Coming up later this hour, the president, or the CEO rather, of the Small Business Association of Michigan, Rob Fowler, continues our discussion on Obamacare, on the Affordable Care Act, and how that is impacting small business here in Michigan. Also, we do a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. Of course, nobody's doing much of that in East Lansing. The Monday morning quarterbacking starts Saturday night, and it continues well into Monday. WKAR's Al Martin, the host of Current Sports, joins us later this hour. And we should also point out that Al's new television program, Current Sports on Television, debuts this Thursday night. So keep that in mind. We hope you can stay close. At the top of the program, highly controversial comments made recently by an MSU professor continue to be a topic of discussion, both locally and beyond. Last week, Professor William Penn sparked an intense backlash after a video surfaced of him suggesting Republicans had raped the country and included many closet racists. A student attending the lecture told MLive that Penn also denigrated Christians and athletes. Last Thursday, the university barred Penn from teaching for the rest of the semester. President Luana Simon said Penn's remarks were out of bounds. The incident has triggered a discussion involving two key features of university life: civility and respect on one hand, and academic freedom and due process on the other. Now, when I left WKAR on Friday afternoon, we had scheduled to open the show with MSU trustee Mitch Lyons, who supports the removal of Professor Penn from the classroom. We had hoped that Mitch Lyons would be able to update the situation in some way with regard to the discussion that's going on amongst the MSU trustees, et cetera, et cetera. And I think he was of the impression that he would be able to do that. I got a text message from Mitch Lyons at 10 to 7 this morning. Mark, not in a position to comment further on the Penn case, so I won't be able to do the interview. Further information is forthcoming, and I don't want to comment until then. Sorry for the late notice. Was hoping to have an update. Mitch Lyons. I reached back to Mitch. I made the case that there is still value in revisiting what's already happened. It did not work out. He has not returned my calls. I will also go to the extent to say that we reached out to President Luana Simon, to Trustee Joel Ferguson, and to Trustee Diane Byram, all very feverishly here in about the last 50 minutes or so, maybe the last hour or so. All of those efforts have come to naught. And I say that as a setup because our first guest this morning, May Kirkendall, and I were planning on discussing whatever it was that Trustee Lyons or any of these other folks might have to say in terms of an update or in terms of revisiting the basics of what has happened here at Michigan State involving Professor Penn. Alas, we do not have any of those folks. So with that as a preamble, I welcome May Kirkendall to WKAR. May is the president of the MSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for asking me. I hope I'm not unusually foolish in accepting your invitation, but I have a great deal of confidence in the academic freedom of the university. I think maybe there's been a misstep here, but I'm here because I trust and believe in this university as one of the citadels of academic freedom.
Let's revisit what happened on Friday. First of all, your group did issue a statement Friday afternoon suggesting that the university had acted too quickly, removing Professor Penn from the classroom. How so?
Okay, I think I'd like to preface my answer in the way that a professor might to at least explain what the principles of academic freedom are and the role of my organization, the American Association of University Professors, in trying to explain, advance, defend academic freedom. So what I would like to explain is that academic freedom is a strong norm of a great university, and it is for the benefit and protection of all of society. It's not so much for the individual protection of a professor, but because the professor's ability to speak freely needs to be clearly always there, unless the professor does something so out of bounds that after very careful process, it's determined that the person is not really exercising academic freedom, but behaving in ways that are outside the bounds of the professorial duty. So we may need to talk a little bit more about why people are so quickly assuming that what he was doing was outside the bounds of the topic of his course.
Do you have any ideas as to why?
Well, I'm hoping I can defer a little bit and explain first more about how this is protection for the student in particular. But my understanding is that the course is Literatures, Cultures, Identities.
Right.
It's an English course, English department course. He is a novelist. He is not actually a PhD purveying standard English department theory about literature. He is a creative writer. He's a fiction writer, and his classes are about creative writing. So I have his syllabus, and I have some of his explanations to students of what he's undertaking to do. One of the backgrounds I understand about his use of the term rape was that he had given them the original derivation of the term rape and what it means, and that he was using it a bit extravagantly in the context of what its original meaning is. And it had to do with not Republicans so much as just sort of one interpretation of our history going back to, the settling of the country. But I'm not capable of fully explaining what he was doing because it's his class and it's his pedagogy. So what a professor does, who's a good professor and a good teacher, is that they try to take risk. Part of our job is to be willing to take a risk. And in order to be a teacher, people try gambits, so to speak, to engage the class. I believe this happened I know it happened on the first day of class, and he was showing them a little bit about a form of hyperbolic speech. I mean, that's one understanding of what he was up to.
Doesn't this type of speech, though, fly directly in the face of another feature of the university landscape, and that is support for civility and respect for all groups? You must have an awful lot of members who feel terribly conflicted about this.
We have yes, people are capable of forming a variety of opinions, but back to due process, none of us knows that much about the premises of the class, exactly, the setting of one short videotape, what he had said before.
Seven minutes, right?
7 minutes is not a good representation of a whole semester and what the person is attempting to do with certain forms of extravagant speech about what we would have to concede is a kind of identity. Remember that the subject of the class is identities. But I don't want to totally discuss what he was doing and try to interpret it because, of course, he's the person best able to do that. And some of his students who really love the man and love his course are good at interpreting that for us.
I've got to ask you a question that I wanted to ask Trustee Mitch Lyons.
All right.
If Professor Penn had said, unions have raped Detroit.
Right.
They're cheap. They've gotten their extravagant salaries,
right,
their lifetime health benefits, and if MSU removed him from the class, would you be here? Would you have issued the statement you did on Friday?
Yes.
If he had said that?
Thank you very much for that question. In point of fact, not to make much reference myself, but people suspect me of not being, in the corner of some of the identity-based scholarship and that sort of thing. But the whole group has, in its history, the AUP frequently defended conservative professors. Let me go to the strong principle of academic freedom, which is that professors are to be free to engage the students with ideas, and their ideas can be expressed in a whole range of types of expression. And so long as it relates to their subject and they haven't gone truly beyond the bounds of of civilized discourse within the tradition of civilization, which is a long one, then they have the protections of academic freedom. So I can tell you without hesitation that I would be on the front lines to protect a conservative professor. I have tried to recruit conservative professors into the English, what department am I in? The law department. I believe in a full range of voices that are robust and are willing to be forthright and, challenge people. I want to make you know that he always in his syllabus tells students, I'm going to say things that may offend you. And if I do, let me know and I will apologize to you. I also know, through having tried to make sure I know a little something, that he had apologized already on Tuesday. His first class, I believe, was on Thursday. He didn't know about the flap. He taught the class on Tuesday. And the student to whom he had said, are you frowning, he decided that that was a gambit that didn't work. You know, professors use little gambits. And in a class of 400, you want to make it more human and to have some interaction with people. But he went and found that student Tuesday morning and directly apologized and said, that didn't work well, and I'm really sorry that I did that. So I want to emphasize to you that he's a creative writer, a fiction writer, who experiments with ways of engaging the class. One way you can do that is to say outrageous things. And so I do believe that he is a person who follows norms of civility. He has ideas about how to engage students that sometimes crash and burn and sometimes work very well.
See, it just gets back to this notion, though, that there is such an emphasis in this institution on civility and respect. And his comments, a lot of people are going to say his comments flew in the face of that. You've got blinding force meeting immovable object. Which one gives?
Well, I don't think that...
Isn't that a fair way to look at
it? The norm of civility is something that is precatory in a way. So you can't try to enforce the norm of civility by micromanaging or fly-specking an individual to say, you're not quite our sort. The way you express yourself is too vivid. It's too challenging for our students. Our students can't handle that. They're a little delicate. And so they're not capable of doing what this professor was challenging them to do, which is to hear things they don't ordinarily hear, respond to them, don't think that they are deprived of voice. Don't think they are deprived of voice. Hear his voice and respond. But I think it's important now, we talked about due process. I don't want to get too enmeshed in one of my colleagues wrote me, who's kind of what you could call a company guy, you know, he tends to want to be with the administration, wrote me when I sent them our statement and wrote, trial by YouTube should be frightening to all of us. So this is a form of trial by YouTube, and it's not in any way consistent with an idea of academic due process. So let me talk to you a little bit about academic due process.
Let me ask you the next question. We don't have the. I think you've made your point adequately here. What does it say that behavior that gets a professor pulled from the classroom can only be shared with the public at a public university by a student sneaking a video camera into a classroom? Doesn't that make a powerful case that there needs to be more scrutiny on the content of what professors have to say?
Well, I think there is a lot of scrutiny. We have an evaluation process that occurs yearly for every professor here.
Why wasn't this already on the radar, though? This got him pulled from the classroom.
I think I could ask you, by contrast, the fact that he has not been pulled means that careful deliberation about his teaching has resulted in he's received a Distinguished Teaching Award. So the faculty in looking at what he does has consistently thought that there is value in it and that he's controversial, but that controversy is not something we should fear. I do want to make sure you understand that due process within the American Academy is always supposed to depend upon faculty input. Faculty groups are supposed to be involved in hiring, administrators are to act on the basis of faculty input. Let me read this to you. At well-run colleges and universities, faculty exercise significant influence over areas including research, the curriculum, subjects and methods of instruction, and faculty status. Now, let me say, such as hiring, promotion, and discipline. Boards and administrators rely on faculty advice in making academic decisions. So in this case, so far as we're aware, there's been no faculty input. And it's important also to understand that suspension of a professor from his teaching responsibilities is considered a severe form of discipline. The fact that the salary has continued doesn't take away the fact that he has been deprived of his primary mission as a professor. Let me try to take another tact here.
This has been an opportunity to witness a whole lot of vitriol online.
Right.
Arguably, people at their partisan worst. Trustee Lyons has been called some awful things online.
Let me express respect for Trustee Lyons, but I would want him to hear me and hear that I think he's off on the wrong track. I say that respectfully.
But Professor Penn and his defenders have been called some awful things too.
Correct.
Okay, so there's
yeah, it's, I hope
it's,
nobody
it's
does
like
that for
it's
me.
Partisan politics at its ugliest.
I agree.
Let's take a more institutional look at this thing. How destructive has this episode been?
The episode, if it's not handled well, is massively destructive. If the episode is handled better than I think it's been handled so far, we would have a public forum, maybe with a whole group of people with different perspectives discussing academic freedom. I'd be glad to participate. I'd be glad to have other people participate because we want the people who think he should be yanked from his class to understand the stakes. If you can do something in such a summary fashion, the AAUP's national standard is that a professor cannot be suspended from teaching without a faculty hearing unless dismissal is in prospect and there's a threat of immediate harm. That was the first impulse I had without even looking at the standards, that to take him out of the classroom doesn't make any sense because there's no threat of immediate harm. Why would it be a crisis? It would be because you think the students are in danger from somebody. There is no danger here other than to some sensibilities by students who may not be fully comprehending what he is telling them that he's going to do. His syllabus explains to them that he's here to potentially upset them, and that's what you need to have happen to you in the course of your learning. You need to have things said to you that maybe shock you, and then you try to integrate it into your own set of worldviews, your capacity to think, your capacity to debate, and your ability to face a world in which there is going to be vigorous debate and people who have more or less ability to express themselves trenchantly.
Duly noted. What do you say to people, however, though, who say this easily qualifies as hate speech, number one, and even worse, publicly subsidized hate speech? For some people, I think your appeals to due process increasingly may fall on deaf ears just because of the what some people would say are just the gratuitous abuse. Is there no way to provoke a student short of what some people regard as hate speech?
Well, first, I find it ironic if the conservative folks are beginning to say we want to throw him out for hate speech because it's one of the iconic, understandings among the conservative side of the spectrum that hate speech rules on a campus violate the First Amendment and that they tend to intimidate people who want to speak openly and that, you know, they're like thought control. So the whole idea of hate speech as something we control on campuses has been somewhat rejected, certainly by the conservatives end of the spectrum, because they are the ones who fear that they're going to be squelched. I mean, they're the ones who maybe fear it more than others. Now we see that you can get squelched on either side of the spectrum. So hate speech is a very dangerous concept that the academy has been chastised by the right side of the spectrum for embracing. I wish I could remember the last part of because I had something else to say.
We're just about out of time.
But anyway, I want to say it was not hate speech. It was an example within a complicated course about literary forms of speech. He explains to them about Plato, so forth and so on. And so the idea of merely unthinkingly attributing it to him as an individual is a mistake. Classrooms are used for experimental language. I'll stop because I can see you want to.
Briefly, let's try to wrap up on this note. Do you think some form of due process is about to unfold here? What lay ahead?
Well, we are urging the administration to, to do a reset. And I guess one of the resets I might ask for is let's try to come together as a community to make sure that people really understand the stakes in demanding that this man be yanked from his job. And I'm not talking about him as an individual. I'm talking about the chill that it would place on everyone. Professors are brave, but they're not that brave. So people are going to dial back the ways that they try to challenge and engage their class. And people experiment with all kinds of ways of doing it. I sometimes tease a student, not much because I don't want to do anything that could be misread. But a year ago, I did a little more teasing than I thought I should have, and I worried about it.
Okay.
And I apologized, but it was, soft teasing, and it was at U of M, so you can do that.
Point taken. May Kirkendall is the president of the MSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Thanks for coming in, May.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Flint, the most violent city in the nation, a failed city, an urban wasteland. These are the headlines that have defined Flint, but they don't tell the whole story. Welcome to Flint is a collaborative project by photographers Juan Madrid and Brett Carlson. The two New York-based artists traveled on and off to Michigan trying to capture the city of Flint. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke to the pair about their project. Brett Carlson said he became interested in Flint after studying Michael Moore's Roger and Me in school.
I graduated from RIT, where Juan and I both attended college in the late winter of 2012. And looking around for positions, I had found an internship listing at the Flint Journal, which is Flint's newspaper. I'd kind of become a little bit fascinated with it through a documentary studies class watching Michael Moore's documentary Roger and Me. While I don't 100% agree with everything with Michael Moore as a person, I really loved his style of work and really loved that particular film a lot. So it kind of grabbed me, and I applied and ended up getting accepted, so I headed there. While I was at the internship, that wasn't the best fit for me, but I really fell in love with the city and just wanted to keep photographing and working in the area. And then started to talk to Juan about it as I was doing it, and he also expressed interest.
Juan, I guess, why were you drawn into this project? Brett was in the city, kind of liked it. Why did you decide to join?
I was shooting a lot in Rochester, having gone to college there, and it's got a similar vibe as Flint, where a big business went down, and there's a lot of more depressed areas, and people are having trouble. So I'm really drawn to areas like that, and having never really been out of New York a lot, I figured it was a great chance to just jump into something new right before I was going back to my final year of college. So I just went there and fell in love with the city like Brett did. People were very welcoming.
When you initially approached this project, I guess, what were your goals? And I guess have those goals or those aims changed as the project has progressed?
Originally, the idea was to have me more portray the good and Brett portray the bad in Flint, and I think that was a really black and white approach. And as we got more comfortable, I know he spent a lot more time in Flint having had the internship, but we both started just moving into more complex stories, and it's just like with any style of photography, as you get more comfortable, you can start telling a more nuanced story.
And Brett, what about you?
One of the trips I know Juan was photographing primarily, and I was kind of, when you make these documentaries and these photo projects, you kind of have sometimes you'll go out there and you might make no pictures that you really like for a whole week. And I was having one of those weeks, and I know I was sitting in the library a lot of the days just reading on the history of Flint and the history of mid-Michigan, and kind of really falling in love with the story, the fact that Flint went through hard times over and over again, but literally through the resilience of the people there has found a way out. And that was worded in a book that was written in the middle of the 20th century before, you know, on the rise of Buick and all these things. So when I read that, I was kind of like, okay, this is kind of a really important factor that Flint can get out of this, and the people of Flint are going to have beauty, strength, and power through whatever is going on. So I think we both kind of start to look for those moments, you know, the beauty and the misery or whatever you want to label it as, where basically there's strength and power and beauty in this pretty desolate place. And we also experience that from hanging out there. I mean, the people there, like Juan said, are very welcoming, and they're literally my best friends live in Flint, Michigan. Some of them are people I photograph, some of them are not, but you know, I have some pretty close bonds with people there, and that's because they're just honest, really welcoming, just good people. I don't know how to express it better than that.
Can you, Brett, can you tell me a little bit of stories behind some of the photographs that you've captured?
Yeah, I mean, my personal favorite photograph is it's a vertical photograph of a man kind of caressing or petting a dog's head. That was taken, you know, the man is a drug dealer, and that's a baby pit bull he had just gotten a few days before. And I'm, you know, kind of hanging out in this house photographing, you know, they're playing dice and, you know, counting money and just kind of whatever. And this little dog is kind of scared and kind of running around the ground, and he's petting and holding and caressing this dog's head. And I kept working around to get that picture, which was, you know, I was really happy with the photograph. But also it kind of had a metaphor of the way the culture of drug dealers and these kind of, you know, I wouldn't say gang lifestyle, but this questionable livelihood happens. You're a young person and you're scared, and then somebody older comes and introduces you to this lifestyle. And I thought that was an exact metaphor with this puppy who's scared, and this guy, you know, is holding him and petting him because he cares for him. You know, but it's kind of the same thing on the streets with the teenagers and young people getting caught up in violence or drugs or problems because they're scared and they don't know what to do next, and these guys offer an answer.
And Juan, what about you? Do you have a favorite photograph with a story behind it that's a favorite, or just a favorite experience in Flint?
Yeah, I took a photograph of a man with Lost Soul tattooed on his face. And he, like, we talked for at least a half an hour, if not an hour, just about his life and where he'd come from, and it actually makes pretty good connection with the dog photo, because at 18 he was he committed a murder that was gang related and then spent around 12 years in prison, but he finally, after another smaller crime, got into or figured out that he didn't want to be spending his life like that, so he went and got a job at a corner store and tried to be a role model for younger people in his neighborhood. And he's just been working at that now and talks to the kids. And just the way he, like, opened his life up to me and let me know all this, like, straight face-to-face on our first meeting was probably one of the most powerful experiences I've had in Flint.
Did you guys ever feel like outsiders kind of coming in and to this and I guess, invading kind of this territory? Or did you find that, you know, people were really welcoming and willing to share? Brett, if you want to speak to this.
It's a mix of both. I mean, we are outsiders. We're not from here. Sometimes that helps. Sometimes people, you know, Flint doesn't get a lot of attention in the media. And I think, you know, the fact that when I wanted to do this, people kind of get excited that someone from outside of Flint wants to pay attention to Flint because they, you know, find it for whatever reason, you know. And I think that's kind of been a plus that, you know, sometimes there's situations where I get into because, you know, oh, yo, this is Brett. He's from New York. And, like, it'll, oh, wow, he's from New York. That must mean he's important, which, you know, I don't really believe is true. I mean, yeah, in ways, I guess it's important what we're doing. But I don't think because I'm from New York, I'm a more important person. I'm not egotistical like that. But I think that it helps. It helps access. And then other times, there's certainly, you know, I think since we've kind of gotten a little bit of press on the project, I think it's been kind of a backlash where people are assuming that we're some kind of outsiders that just want to show the negative side of Flint. So that's been kind of troubling, to say the least.
Yeah, I saw that in looking at one of the pieces that they did about you, and I was a little confused because I felt like there were positive images in there, and I think a lot of the criticism that was that you guys were, a lot of the photographs were negative centric.
I think we kind of had the same reaction. I know I did. Where that's not my. I mean, it's neither of our agendas is to paint Flint in a negative light at all. We both are very fond of it, to say the least. But also, I didn't see that, you know, and there was one or two commenters on the feature shoot article that were kind of like, well, there's clearly beauty in this misery. But I think, you know, people that act like what we're showing is the only thing in Flint. I mean, when you have a place that has estimates between 30 and 50% vacancy rates and high unemployment, and, you know, they went from 70,000 employees at GM to 7,000, and there hasn't been another big employer come in, and, you know, dwindling citizens rates or, you know, amount of citizenship in the city of Flint. And you can go on any side of the city and see, you know, prostitutes and drug dealers and burnout houses. You know, these things are not in any way hidden. That being said, our project isn't all about that, and that edit was particularly, I don't know. It's hard to find truly positive things that are changing the community, I think. And I think that's hard in any city. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly a goal, at least personally for me. I've been working towards that and working on that while I photograph. It's just kind of hard to say, like, well, this community garden will fix, you know, the 40% vacancy rate and the fact the city can't even afford to tear down buildings. Like, I don't think, you know, when you tell me to focus on that like it's a solution, I think I'm lying to everybody.
Well, and what about you? How do you think, or has this project changed you as a photographer?
I wasn't really shooting people a lot beforehand, and now I photograph people all the time. But more about the negative, like, view of the project, mm-hmm. I think it's, for me at least, it's gone from being about the black and whites to more about the struggle. And I do think that the project, for me at least, is kind of sad because it's just the atmosphere in Flint. Like, it's what it used to be, and it's not that anymore. But I mean, I think that's just a big part of it. And for me, at least, I'm trying to create a body of work that shows these issues in an American city and why we as a people allow the system to be run like this and to allow that kind of conversation to kind of start.
What do you think, Brett, that you've learned about Flint through this project? And I guess, what do you hope audiences or people who view your photos take away?
I had a conversation with another photographer, and we were kind of going through the body of work on my side, my section of photographs. And, you know, we were kind of discussing the fact that in America there's a few of these, like, sacrificial cities, was the kind of loose, not appropriate term we use. But basically, where industry was huge, you know, Flint was the richest city in the country per capita at one time. And then, you know, the employer leaves, and then the city goes down. And it's all in the name of somebody's stocks or someone's financial portfolio or something like that. And I think that's kind of the broader thing I've kind of learned, is just seeing that reality up close and personal. And I think just anything, it's just a complex issue. There's not an easy solution to the problem that Flint faces or other cities like Flint face. But at the same time, you know, through the resilience of the local people and the, you know, the bootstrap initiatives, I think that's the way the problem will be solved. But that's still, you know, that's the best answer I've found. And I don't know if that is the answer still. It's just a guess.
Well, and what are your guys' next steps? Do you have more photos to take? Are you guys planning on putting this into a book or something? Yeah.
Honestly, I'd like to be shooting there as much as possible, but funds are just always there. And we are hoping to, well, we are planning on making a newsprint publication, which we want to release in Flint for free and then sell for as cheap as we can elsewhere, just to start getting this conversation within the community itself, but also so other people see how it is.
Photographers Juan Madrid and Brett Carlson, their project is called Welcome to Flint. Both of you guys, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're with us. On March 1st of this year, $85 billion in forced federal spending cuts kicked in what has become known as the sequester. It's taken some time to assess the effects of these cuts, but as the end of the fiscal year approaches on September 30th, the new budgets are starting to reflect the decrease in spending. One area where the sequestration is showing substantial effects is in the area of scientific research. Reports have been documenting laboratory closings and layoffs, and one significant study even showed that nearly one-fifth of American scientists are at least contemplating a move overseas because of the decline in funding. With us now to assess the sequestration's effects on scientific research here on campus are two MSU scientists. Rob Britton is an associate professor in microbiology. Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you.
And Norb Kaminsky is the director of the Center for Integrative Toxicology. Welcome back, Norb.
Thanks, Mark.
Describe, if you will, both of you, just the environment for you, Norb.
Okay.
The environment, we're led to believe, is pretty bleak for people in your line of work.
Yeah. Well, maybe to put this in some kind of context, I think many people don't realize that if faculty want to do research in an academic setting, that money does not come from the university. You actually have to compete for research funding either from a federal agency, foundations, or from private industry. And so really the majority of funding does come from federal sources, primarily NSF and NIH, National Institutes for Health. And as the sequester has kicked in, so to speak, the result has been a very large cut in research funding, which means fewer grants being funded. But even those grants that are funded, they've been cut in terms of the dollars that those investigators will receive. So it's a pretty significant impact.
I saw a couple of reporters kicking this around, I think, on Huffington Post online, and they brought up what I assume is a very dramatic example of the Internet. The Internet started out as a Department of Defense, relatively obscure Department of Defense project. And it led to a complete revolution in the way people communicate, live their lives, get information, et cetera, et cetera. Is that that's probably the most dramatic illustration of this at work that I can probably come up with. There's truth to that, though, in your view.
No, definitely. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we need to let the public know about federal funding is that the government funds a lot of work that industry won't. So a lot of people have been saying that industry should pick up the bill now for some of the money that the federal government's not doing. But to give you an example where this model breaks down is the issue of antibiotic resistance. So we all know that this is a huge problem that's going to be facing our world in the next 25 years, yet no pharmaceutical company will ever get in the business of developing new antibiotics right now because it's just financially not worth it. So it's very important that we have government funding to fund areas where development's needed so that we can get projects or we can get studies to areas where then pharmaceutical companies and biotechnology companies see the value then in investing in it. So it's very critical that we keep this money going.
I'd like to ask both of you how, if at all, this has played out in your own labs or in your own departments. Norb, yeah. Have you seen the effects of budget planning and less money to work with?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, our Sunner grant that was just recently funded took a 13% cut, which was a fairly significant cut, and then most of the what are called individual investigator grants, those typically are being cut anywhere from 5 to 10%. Now, some of those funds may come back, but later on in the year, but it's unlikely.
Rob, what about you?
Yeah, so same story for me. I have a couple of NIH grants that have been cut anywhere from 6 to 8%. But really how it affected us is we submitted a grant on osteoporosis and the use of probiotic bacteria to suppress bone loss back in March of 2012. And it went through the whole process, got a fundable score, went through what they call NIH Council and was approved. But then the sequester hit, and it was then declined for funding. We had to resubmit in March of 2013. But the story ends well because back in June of 2013, we actually got this grant. But basically, the delay of 9 months of getting that funding meant that a postdoc that we had on the job, we had to lay off. And she has now taken another position. And it really slowed us down by putting us behind for a year. But also, now we have to hire a new person to train. So it's really had a big impact on us.
What do you make of this extraordinary stat that nearly one-fifth of American scientists are at least contemplating a move overseas because of the decline of funding?
Well, this actually does not surprise me. I see the impact on our students as well, and that, you know, they're thinking about alternative career paths other than doing research in an academic setting. But I would like to just circle back to the point you made a few minutes ago, and that is, you know, this idea of just the amount of advances that this country has made through investment in research and technology. This is really what has separated, I think, this country from many other places around the world. And I think if we divest from investing in research and technology, we will slowly fall out of this leadership position. And I realize that we have limited resources, but I think it's time not to just have across-the-board cuts, but really think about in a targeted way where we want to put our country's treasure, so to speak.
Is there any kind of organized effort to change people's minds that you're aware of?
I think scientific societies have been taking a leadership role there in terms of contacting Congress and having members of their societies contact Congress. But I'm not sure how effective these processes have been.
Yeah, I would say the sequester, just the way it was implemented. I mean, there's been very little leeway for how institutes are able to take these cuts, and I think the reason these were so severe this time was that the cuts actually came halfway through the year, so they actually had to go through a full year of cuts in about 6 months. And so, for example, the National Science Foundation essentially decided to take those cuts only on new grants, and so they didn't cut any existing grants. So we had a grant submitted to the NSF and got three glowing reviews, better than many of the grants I've had funded, but it was declined just simply because they have very few funds for new grants right now.
We're talking with Rob Britton, associate MSU professor in microbiology, and Norbert Kaminsky, director of the Center for Integrative Toxicology. We're addressing the cuts that and their impact due to the federal sequester on scientific research. If necessity is the mother of invention, do you find yourself getting more creative here in terms of how you do get money? Are you looking in places for funding that you haven't looked at before?
Absolutely.
So,
for example, looking more, as Rob had indicated, try and find partnership with industry, for example, private industry, either individual companies, or there's an effort right now through Michigan State to develop a partnership with a group called the Grocery Manufacturers Association in the area of food toxicology. So actually develop a partnership that would be funded in part by the food industry in terms of research that would be of interest to them.
Now, does that raise concerns for you, though, to the extent that if you were successful, you've got more of your research underwritten by the industry itself? That's always raised some degree of concern.
Well, the one key to this, and there's full agreement both on the industry side as well as academic side, is that the research would be completely independent of any type of influence from industry. And if it wasn't that way, it would be of little value either to industry or academia. And so there would be a lot of oversight in how this would be done, including having partners from government that would be part of advisory committees that would oversee what research would be conducted.
Yeah, MSU has a very good Business Connect office. And so, of course, we don't give up any rights to publication. We keep all the intellectual property. So I think it's okay to have industry partners. I do think, though, for Norb and I, we both work in areas where we can find industry partners quite easily. But there's a lot of science that goes on here that's very basic. And, at face value, the public might think, well, why are we studying this? But there's so many examples of findings that 15, 20 years down the road make big inroads. We're trying to develop therapeutic delivery vectors right now to develop or to deliver therapeutic proteins to the gut. And the only reason we're able to be so successful in what we're doing is there have been 20 years of how proteins are secreted, all this work that was done that you would say, well, that's just so basic. Why would that ever be of any value? It becomes valuable much later.
Mm-hmm. Now, are both of you acquainted with people who are amongst this group that is considering leaving the field or moving overseas? Is it common to run into people?
It's happened. In fact, one of my postdoc colleagues, he was a professor at Stanford. He was not awarded tenure. And essentially, when he was denied tenure, he moved to Singapore. So he's now running a laboratory in Singapore.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and the other impact it's having is on young faculty members because of changes in how grants are reviewed now at NIH. They only allow you to submit the same grant twice, and often it will take 3 to 4 years to develop enough preliminary results so that you would even be competitive for one of these grants. So if you don't get it in the 2 tries that you have, then basically you're really left with probably one option, that's to leave the university and go someplace else. So this is actually a huge problem for young investigators and really the whole next generation of scientists that we may lose.
So there's a potential long-term impact to society, but as well to a number of really well-educated, highly trained people trying to make their way forward in their profession.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Has nothing like sequestration unfolded in other countries? Or is it just a higher enough priority in Europe or wherever that the impact has been lessened over there?
Well, yeah. I mean, Europe has their own, obviously, financial struggles going on now, and Spain's probably the biggest country that's really struggling. There's a lot of their scientists that are looking to get out of their country, too. And so but I think what the sequestration did, and there's some data on this, is that NIH funds 2,500 universities, over 300,000 people. And so when you take a 10% cut, you can just see essentially you're eliminating jobs. And those jobs then have a ripple effect to companies that then sell products to us to do laboratory research. But with the cuts we took, we're the only developed country doing major biomedical research that actually has decreased the amount of money that we put in based on our GDP over the last 2 years. And so as Norb was saying, we are just going to be making ourselves less competitive if we do this. But let me just say, the cuts are obviously important for the entire country, and we realize that, you know, people are going to need to tighten their belts everywhere. I would just say that for us to stay competitive, we really need to not only invest in scientific research but education in general, and keep that on the forefront of us becoming and staying the competitive nation we are.
We have been discussing the impact of federal sequestration on scientific research. We thank Rob Britton, an associate professor in microbiology, and Norb Kaminsky, director of the Center for Integrative Toxicology, both at Michigan State University. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. We're going to indulge in a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, which, as I said earlier in the show, I think Monday morning quarterbacking has been going on all weekend. The Monday morning quarterbacking is starting earlier than ever, and the topic, the big hot topic, of course, is Michigan State University's offense as far as its football team goes. We welcome current sports Al Martin to Current State. How are you?
How you doing, Mark? You all right? Good to see you, man.
I am well. The focus is obviously on the quarterback situation here at Michigan State. Where is the debate here Monday morning with regard to Connor Cook, with regard to Andrew Maxwell, and everybody else?
Mark, you know what? I should be asking you that question, because right now no one has a clue who looks to be vying or has a better position to have that starting quarterback position. I mean, we saw 3 quarterbacks on Saturday. We saw Connor Cook getting the start. We saw Tyler O'Connor, the redshirt freshman. And then, of course, we saw Andrew Maxwell in the second half. Now, when you look at those 3 performances throughout Saturday, neither one of them were very impressive. Nothing really stood out. If anyone, if you look at those three quarterbacks, Tyler O'Connor, the redshirt freshman, he had the only play of the drive for the offense. The only drive for the offense that went down and actually scored with the Jeremy Langford touchdown. But other than that, I mean, it's a snoozer to watch this MSU offense, Mark, to be honest with you. I mean, really the highlight and the talk of this whole team has been the defense, which has been stellar. And I tell you what, later on today's current sports at 1 p.m. on WKRI AM 870, D'Antonio is the most frustrated I've ever seen him in a press conference. You got to hear the sound bites. But then again, it's a weird press conference because he comes in very frustrated, and then all of a sudden near the end of the press conference, he's pretty playful and even kind of humorous at the end-to-end things. It's you got to hear it. Later on, it was very interesting to say the least.
Who do you expect to start next Saturday? Have you thought that far ahead?
I have really not thought that far ahead, and I'm getting a headache this early in the morning trying to think about it, Mark. But I'll tell you what, if you look on just individual numbers and individual performance, I think you got to go with the redshirt freshman Tyler O'Connor when you look at it. I mean, Maxwell, nothing really stood out from his perspective of things. Connor Cook, the thing with Connor Cook is he's very mobile, but he's inaccurate down the field. When you talk about him pinpointing targets down the field. Now, Tyler O'Connor, he's a little bit mobile, and he's more accurate than I think Maxwell and Connor Cook are. But the thing is, he's so inconsistent with it. But he did have the only drive for the MSU offense that led to a touchdown, which kind of gives him the advantage if you look at things on paper, Mark.
Is it fair to focus this much strictly on the quarterback situation, or are there other factors that we should also be looking at?
We should be talking a lot about this MSU defense, which ranks nationally among the creme de la creme of top.
I mean, what about elsewhere on the offense?
On the offense, the running back position. That's what a lot of people are not talking about right now. You talk about Nick Hill, you talk about Riley Bullitt and Jeremy Langford. I think that trio did not play bad last game. They were pretty consistent. Nick Hill looked good. He bursted out for a few yards. Riley Bullitt can get out in the flat a little bit. And Jeremy Langford, he's a pretty good power back when he gets some head of steam on certain plays.
Al Martin of WKAR's Current Sports. Hear more at 1 o'clock this afternoon on AM 870 WKAR. Thanks, Al.
Hey, no problem, Mark.
Appreciate it. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our Detroit Water Renaissance series by taking a look at Detroit's walleye fishing industry. Also, we take a look at Great Lakes Week 2013. All that and more coming up Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry and to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.